to develop there. Quiet voltage. But I'm just amazed that you hear these things sitting out there with 1,200 PSI in it. And nobody's ever thinking about these things bursting. But they never do. Back to you, Dick.
The nickel hydrogen batteries that are there now that are about to be replaced, 12 of them, and you're going to replace them with 6 lithium ion batteries. Those nickel hydrogen, I presume, were chosen because they got very long life, but I guess they've already been there 10 or 15 years. I wonder what they predict as the life of the lithium ion. The good news of lithium ion is it's got higher energy density, more watt-hours per pound or watt-hours per cubic meter. That's the good news. But if you ever get a failure of one of those, and you and I have seen a number of news reports of laptops and vapor cigarettes and cell phones that have lithium ion batteries, or lithium polymer, one or the other. And when they go into a failure mode and explode, they do some really nasty outgassing. So I'm a little worried about the failure mode of a lithium ion could be quite a bit more devastating than the slow failure mode of a nickel hydrogen. Over to you, Paul, K2LIW.
Yeah, I went to a couple of sites. NASA has a PDF file, a couple of other websites, but not, you know, to me, NASA is like the Bible, you know. They talk about the lithium ions, and from what I remember reading collectively between the different websites, that they talk about the safety, and these batteries are really no different. Lithium ion, no different than, I forget, the jetliner that had all the fires and problems. But they bypassed all that. They have all kinds of safety built into this. So NASA has made sure that whatever off-gassing or explosions or fires that these things could possibly have here on Earth is not going to happen up there. They went over it naturally with the engineers in Japan. They were built in Japan, these particular batteries. So, and this pallet is huge. You should see the size of this pallet. Each battery pack that weighs like 500 pounds is, well, 430 pounds. But each one, they each have to have a special adapter now. So roughly 500 pounds per battery. They gave it in centimeters, but I'll give it roughly in feet. It's roughly about a little over 3 feet, about 40 inches long by 35 inches deep, probably about 20 inches wide. So it's like a big suitcase, and that's just one. And then they have 6 of these to replace 12 of these.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Then, with one section, you know, they have to do this 4 different times over the next couple of years.
What are they going to do 4 different times? I'm missing that. They're taking out 12 of the old batteries and replacing with 6 new ones, and they're going to do that whole procedure 4 different times? Back to you on that one, Paul.
Before I forget, I have looked furiously to try to figure out how many amp hours collectively it would be, but I'd have to do it mathematically. I'd have to find out what one cell is and then figure it out from there. The total amount of batteries on the International Space Station are 48 of these 500 pound things. So right now they're replacing 12 of these things. So they're going to replace 12. they've got to be removed from what, let's call them their sockets. They've got to be removed from the pallet that it's serving right now. The solar panels is actually on S4, the starboard truss section 4. They're going to do eventually starboard 6 and then port 4 and port 6. But right now they're doing starboard 4. So they're removing 12 of them to be replaced with 6. Out of those 12 that they're taking out, 9 are going to be burnt up over the Pacific, and the other 3 are going to be stored on the International Space Station for a couple of years. Back to you, Dick.
If I understand you correctly, Paul, each of these batteries puts out 160 volts. Do we know how many volt amperes, how many joules, or do we know how many... do we know volt amperes? Do we know watt hours? What units of energy storage does each one of these batteries have, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, I looked at that information. I got little dribs and drabs. Nothing I could confirm with. You know, I'll look further into it. But it must be a tremendous amount of numbers. Big number. Yeah, you know, to be able to power, well, they say 50 ohms. Wow. Sounds like a lot of amperage. And, you know, naturally, it's... The power from the solar panels are charging the batteries when it's in daylight. Plus, the panels are actually, you know, via the batteries, you know, through the batteries are running the station. And then, of course, the station goes into darkness roughly 30, 35 minutes a day. And it's a day, which, you know, their day is, they have 16 sunrise sunsets, but each orbit is an hour and a half. So out of the hour and a half, let's call it a half hour is in darkness. So that's when these batteries are putting out power. So this all started around 2000. The latest group of batteries that got up there were 2007. And yeah, I'd like to find out the amp hours, wattage, and all of that, and amperage. But I don't know yet. Back to you.
I'm guessing in sunlight, you're not only charging batteries, but running all your equipment. And so you've got 120 kilowatts. And by the way, 120 kilowatts out of your solar cells will power 50 homes. That's a little over 2 kilowatts per house. That's a rough number that's used. On average, per 24-hour day, a private home is somewhere between 1,500 and 2,500 watts, I think. Numbers like that. Yeah, when you're doing cooking and clothes washing, you come up to much bigger numbers, but you only do that for a small number of hours per day. But do you have reason to believe that the International Space Station can use full power output of all of their machinery by way of battery power during the times they're in the darkness? Over you, Paul, K2RIW.
Oh, yeah, and they have plenty of power to spare right now. There's no problem. Even when the shuttle was going up there, they would power up the shuttle. They essentially hooked jumper-wise up, and the shuttle would use the power from the solar panels. And that's why they started getting extended missions. In the beginning of the shuttle missions, you could go up for like 12 days at the most. And then toward the end, they were getting 18 days out of the mission because the thing could stay docked a lot longer. And they do the same with the cargo vehicles that go up there. The HTV will stay up there for months at a time. The same with Dragon. And the same with the Cygnus cargo vehicle, Progress, with the Russians. And even the manned space Soyuz, the two Soyuz spaceships that are presently attached to the International Space Station. They need power for at least 6 months, and they can go up to 225 days before they have to come back. So, plenty of power. They don't know what to do with it all. It's really a very good system. Also, when they work on it, they have, I think there's 8 different ways you could you know, 18 foot different circuit breakers. They got these big rotary switches. Let me drop it. So you can shut down, you know, solar galactic panels, you know, number four, and then you can run on six. In fact, they did that for quite a while. They had number, I think P4 was shut down for a while. P4 or P6, I forget, but it was shut down a while because they had some kind of problem. They thought it was this, it wasn't that, and it shut down for like months at a time. And then during one of the spacewalks last year, they re-energized that. So even, you know, for months at a time, they run at three-quarters the power that they could have been running at. And without chancing on anything, everything kept running. Now, the other thing is they have this space robot called Dexter. It's on the outside of the space station. Since New Year's, actually New Year's Eve, it's been going around loosening up bolts. They want to make sure that the astronauts don't have any problems when you get out there, and they can't turn a bulb or something. So this thing has been doing that. It's been relocating some of the batteries on its own. I think the main job for the astronauts is wire hookups and cable hookups and relocating these big adapters, you know, 100-pound adapters. They need different type of adapters. The battery size is different. You know, they're switching over from lithium to lithium ion, and there's less positives and negatives coming out of these things. You know, they used to be 12 and now they're 6, so they need these big plate adapters that they're using that are pretty wide to make these conversions. So, but they got this Dexter robot. It's bigger than me. It's a 10-foot thing. It looks like it's got like arms and a torso and everything. And it's loosening things up and getting ready to, in fact, moving batteries. Let me drop it. And with that system, using that thing, the spacewalks will, they will only need two spacewalks, one this Friday, and then one 7 days later, Friday, you know, the next Friday, to do the complete changeover. And without the Dexter robot on the end of a robotic arm doing this work, they said it would take six spacewalks to do what they have to do. So it's the biggest use of an external mechanical robot thing to do what they got to do. That they've used it before, but this is the most complex job. And this, by the way, the astronauts aren't using this. It's being all controlled by Mission Control in Houston. They're ones operating. So as they're sleeping, you know, these batteries are being interchanged and everything. So it's an amazing structure up there. Back to you there. WS2M.
For a good number of years now, Paul, the space shuttle hasn't existed. We stopped using it because of its failure modes. We've had two crashes of them. The space shuttle was literally designed to have a cargo hold big enough to launch, I think, the largest object that has ever been put into space, which is the Hubble Space Telescope. So the cargo hold of the space of the shuttle was just the right size to house the Hubble Space Telescope. We've now got a whole bunch of companies that are bringing us progress, like shipments and whatever. All kinds of hardware is being put into space these days by other facilities. However, let me drop it. Of all the launch facilities of all the companies and all the countries that exist right now, I'm going to make a guess that none of them could launch an object as large as the Hubble Space Telescope, both because of its size and its total mass. I think that capability doesn't exist yet, but I bet you're going to tell me that Elon Musk is moving in the direction where he could do that very easily in the next year or two. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, well, he's definitely going in that direction. I would say he's got a test coming up this year with the Falcon 9 Heavy. And now he's just calling it the Falcon Heavy. They've changed the name on that, which is instead of 9 engines, it's got 27 engines, so 5.5 million pounds of thrust. I think he could probably do pretty good with that. Definitely European Space Agency with the Ariane 5, and it's got two big solid booster rockets attached to it. Yeah, they would have a shot with the Hubble. They're the ones in contract for 2018 for James Webb Space Telescope. Now look how big that thing is. When that opens up, it's going to be as big as a tennis court. So that's going to be launched by ESA, European Space Agency. Now that's a massive thing. I don't think it, although it's big, I don't know if the weight is. I think the Hubble was heavier. I'll have to check on that. But I think it was. By the way, James Webb Space Telescope had some problems on December 3rd. It was going through a test at Green Belt, Maryland. They go through these shake tests, the cryogenic tests. One of the tests showed that it was an anomaly. But since that time, the latest reading, I see that they haven't found any damage that occurred, but one of the accelerometers that they had in the test facility showed a problem. But they checked it with everything. You know, they shake it, they put sound on it, duplicate a launch situation, and they didn't like what they saw, but they took it all apart, took it out of the test facility, not apart, but they worked on it. So it looks like there's no delay. Still scheduled for, I believe it's September of 2018. So we'd like to see that thing get up there. Back to you, Dick. Yeah, we'll talk about people launching rockets. They're getting bigger all the time. I got a whole list.
Yeah, when I asked the question about launching Hubble again, so to speak, I completely forgot about James Webb. Is James Webb, when it's all packed up, ready to be launched, do you believe it is bigger in volume, longer in length, larger in diameter, but bigger in volume than Hubble? And do you believe it has more or less mass than Hubble? Hubble has this huge mirror, which I think is 94 inches in diameter. And James Webb has a whole lot of super light mirror panels. It's got, what, two or three times the area of Hubble's mirror. But these are much lighter individual mirror panels. So what's your guess as to the total volume of James Webb versus Hubble and mass? WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, well, Hubble didn't have to unpack itself after it got up. Yeah, it had solar panels. It had an antenna. You know, that had to be deployed, but that's it. James Webb has, I think they said, 100 and some odd different mechanisms that have to work to open this thing. Hubble had that heavy 8-foot diameter mirror. That was probably the biggest part of that. The reason that weighed so much, it was thick glass. You don't have any of that with James Webb. James Webb is 21 feet in diameter. It's got 18 different sections. It's going to all open up like an origami contraption. So it's going to be folded up pretty good inside the Ariane 5 fairing. watches from French Guiana. And then this whole Sun Shield 5 layer thing that's going to be unfurled. Yeah, it'll be as large as a tennis court, blocking the 21-foot diameter mirror. But it's all very light. It's like Mylar. And the mirror itself has got a gold plating on it. And it's, you know, that's the best for ultraviolet. What is it? Infrared. Let me drop it.
Yeah, you just said a mouthpiece. The mirror on Hubble, 94 inches.
Repeater, timeout.
94 inches is approximately 8 feet. That would be 96 inches. And the mirror is most of the diameter of Hubble. So I'm going to guess the total diameter of Hubble is under 10 feet is my guess. And James Webb is 21 feet in diameter. Approximately twice the diameter. So unless James Webb is half the length of Hubble, it's got a lot more area than Hubble. A lot more volume than Hubble. Sounds to me like James Webb is bigger in size, but because of exotic materials, it might not be heavier in mass. WS2N, K2IW.
Yeah, I know that your back plate and all, it's all beryllium, and it's supposed to be very light, very strong, and it's coefficient doesn't, you know, for heating and cooling, it doesn't change. It's supposed to be the perfect material for what they're using it for. And by the time it's built with a solar panel and fancy gyroscopic, it's not using regular gyros, you know, it's using a modern lightweight gyro system. You don't have these gigantic spinning things like you have on the Hubble. You know, those things are heavy. So it's not a bad, I think you have 6 on Hubble, you know, you need 4, 2 as a backup or something like that. You have none of that on James Webb. So they've kept it light, but it is going to be big. You know, that mirror is 18 different segments. It's got to open. And then there's a hole right through the middle, and that's the secondary mirror. And then there's the tertiary mirror involved. All this got to work. The cryogenics on board to keep it even colder. They might almost down to like an absolute zero or something, a couple of degrees above that. Lots got to work. It's going to take, I think, about 3 weeks to completely open up all these parts as it's on its way out to the L2 location, Lagrange Point 2. So.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Hubble, sounds to me like it probably has more mass than James Webb. So the number of steps that have to go just right when that thing deploys, unfolds itself. Wow. And there's no repair procedure capability. Now, orienting Hubble is done with these massive inertial wheels, which have given them a significant reliability problem. Every repair mission, the major thing that had to be repaired was replacing defective inertial wheels. What is the alternative that James Webb is using? How does James Webb orient itself? How does it steer itself if it's not using something like inertial wheels? I can see it using thrusters, but you don't want to do that a lot because you're using a consumable fuel when you use a thruster. And I guess you could put a solar sail out there and let the solar pressure move it. But that's a very slow motion as I see it. So where is the real orientation James Webb? And do we know the approximate mass of either Webb or Hubble? Over to you, Paul. K2IW.
I'm thinking 30,000 pounds for Hubble, but I can find it. If I get off the radio, I bring up Wikipedia, it would tell me in 2 seconds, James Webb Space Telescope and Hubble, side by side, I can tell you everything about it, but without looking that up, I'd say Hubble's heavier, you know, and then thrusters, yeah, they have thrusters and everything on board, but once it's stable, once they have it in that Lagrange point, don't forget, now it's not in orbit, they call it a halo orbit, it's moving around about 500,000 miles, some kind of a halo location, 1 million miles away from Earth. And all they need to do is have this one panel that's, you know, facing Earth, and they could move it. They could move this panel one way or the other. And that's going to pick up any of the solar wind, and you'll be able to adjust the attitude of James Webb just using that. Whether they have some onboard inertial wheels or not, I don't know. But I know that the primary way to do it is they're actually going to use the solar wind, and it does have solar power. And I haven't figured out what kind of batteries it has, but I haven't seen that yet. But I'm sure they got to be charging batteries. But it's, you know, it's always got to be facing the sun, so maybe they don't need batteries. Maybe they got big capacitors. I don't know. I haven't seen anything about batteries yet, Dick. Have you? WS2N.
Oh, I haven't. I did just Google the word Hubble. It's bigger than I expected. 13.2 feet in diameter. No, I'm looking at this wrong. 13.8 feet in diameter, 43.3 feet long, and uses 2,800 watts. Wow. 13.8 feet. So it's only an 8 1/2 foot diameter mirror. There's a lot of empty space around that mirror, apparently. 13.8 feet in diameter. I guess an awful lot of it is also the cylindrical container. It's simultaneously a heat shield, isn't it? It's got all kinds of insulation, so you don't cook on one side and freeze on the other. So by way of Wikipedia, we can immediately find out the dimensions of Hubble versus James Webb. Although, in this, you know, the way a Wikipedia works, you get this list on the right-hand side of all the parameters of whatever you're looking up. And they got everything there except the mass, the weight. I don't see the weight. And I think you estimated 13,000 pounds. Is that what you said, Paul? K2LAW?
I'd be surprised if that's all it is. I think it's 30,000 pounds. So I think one of the big modules that the biggest module that they bought up was the Kibo module for Japan for the space station. I think that was like almost 30,000. So I'm sure Hubble's got to be in that category. So, yeah, well, the magic number is always 14 feet, you know, roughly 14 feet, because that was the diameter of the inside of the cargo bay of the space shuttle. So they knew they were building the space shuttle, so when all these parts were being built, they were built, at, you know, using that kind of number. So, I mean, some of the Russian parts that were sent up had nothing to do with the shuttle. But some of them did. So they just used that as a standard number. So, I don't know, maybe you found the information. I wouldn't be surprised if it was 30,000 pounds. You know, I've read it, I'm just going by the top of my head. But it was way up there. Yeah, it was like a four-story building. If you remember them working on it, you know, they were working at the bottom part of it, and this thing was sticking way above the cargo bay. Back to you, Dick.
In the early days of Hubble repairs, failure, and end of life, Has anyone, even for a short period of time, dreamed of taking the space shuttle, going out there and capturing Hubble, putting it back in the cargo bay, and bringing it back home? Was there ever a millisecond in which people in the past considered doing that? Over to you, Paul, K2LAW.
When it was being designed, they said, yeah, we'll just take the shuttle, we'll bring it back, we'll work on it, if there's anything broken, we'll send it back up again. But they gave that up, that thought up real quick, and the weight of this thing started to increase. But yeah, that was definitely a plan. As well as a couple of other things. I mean, they actually did bring back satellites. A couple of satellites over the years, early in the early shuttle missions. So yeah, there was one that was not working. I went up there and grabbed it and brought it back. Then there was the LDF, what was the Long Duration Exposure Facility. And the LDEF was a big thing. It was like, not as big as Hubble, but, maybe half the size. And they put it up in orbit. And it was supposed to stay there 6 months or so to test all these. They had all this different material on the outside of the satellite. And they were going to test the reactions from the cosmic rays and the meteorites that were dropping. As that micrometeorites hit all the different parts. Well, then, in between that time, you had the Columbia disaster. So it wasn't until 4 years later, 4 or 5 years later, that they went up and got the LDEF, the Long Duration Exposure Facility, and they put it in the back of the shuttle, closed the cargo doors, and flew it home. And that was a pretty heavy thing. So they did do some of that, but nothing with the weight of Hubble. That was big. Let's see. If there's any other topics. One thing I want to talk about is next week, by the way. I want to do a year in review. We'll try that. Everything from 2016. Back to you, Dick. WS to us.
Quite a few of the news reports, ABC, CBS, NBC, and MSNBC, are giving us end-of-the-year reports as to who died and what was accomplished. So it sounds like you're making a report like that with the Space Survey report. Wow. That sounds like a lot of work, Paul. You sure you want to do that? And by the way, when it comes to capturing Hubble and bringing it back on the shuttle, if you do a quick back-of-the-envelope calculation, if it's roughly 30,000 pounds up there moving at 17,500 miles an hour, and you put it into the cargo hold, and you're going to bring it back home. Sounds easy. But those tiles on the leading edge and on the nose of the space shuttle has to dissipate all that extra heat. The total amount of, what's the word for it, joules of energy of something as massive as 30,000 pounds moving 17,500 miles an hour and by way of atmospheric drag, as we call it, not really drag, but you know what I mean, you get all that extra heating of the tiles. Boy, you better believe that those tiles have to be in excellent condition, or you better take a much more shallow dive into the atmosphere in order to control that extra heating. The laws of physics means that you have to dissipate all of that kinetic energy on Hubble in order to bring it back, and the tiles have to do that. I think you're going to come close to melting down those tiles. I don't think they brought back large, voluminous objects. That long-duration exposure thing is a thing with a large, large volume. But it didn't.
Repeater, timeout.
But I'll bet it didn't have anywhere near the mass of Hubble. I'll bet you it was only 10 or 20% of mass of Hubble's mass. WS2N, K2IW.
Yeah, well, Hubble's mass is, I gotta check it. I'm pretty sure it's 30,000, but it's not that far different than, you know, naturally they took it up. So you say, well, they can take it down, but they could have. They believed they could have, but they didn't want to take that chance. That was the beginning of the talking about this, probably in the late 1970s. But the carbon on the front of the shuttle, that would have held. The only reason it didn't happen on STS 107 was, you know, for Columbia, because of the tiles, the insulation hit the shuttle. So, you gotta remember that the shuttle is, what, 230,000 pounds or something itself, so you're only adding another 30,000 pounds to the cargo. So, but, you know, that was a massive thing. The shuttle itself was the payload. You're putting that payload of 230,000 pounds into orbit every time you shot that thing up there. So, that's quite a bit. I don't think I gave out the website for Blue Origin. You know, I like the one that they came out with. So they have a... That's the one where you can look at everything that they're doing. They're going to eventually charge money to put passengers on this thing to do suborbital flights. And it's blueorigin.com/technology. So if you do that, you can navigate through their very good website and look at all the things that they're doing and see a couple of their videos. They're very short. Even their last launch, when they tested the abort system and the booster came back successfully and landed on Earth for reusability for the fifth time, when they did that abort test, I watched the whole thing live, and it was not long. You know, once it went up, it was 15 minutes before we really got to the end. They shortened this whole thing to about 3 minutes, so you don't get bored watching this. It's pretty good. And back to you, Dick. No, I just went off the Hubble topic, but back to you, WS2M.
I should know this, but I'm not sure. Is Blue Origin the name of a company really run by Elon Musk? Over to you, Paul.
No, that's the... Elon Musk has SpaceX, and Blue Origin is run by Jeff Bezos. B-E-Z-O, I think it is. And he's the one that owns Amazon.com. So that's his thing. Now, on this website, they don't have the newest thing that he's involved with by 2019, which is what, losing track, I guess 3 years from now. Well, maybe, yeah, 2.5, 3 years from now, he'll be testing his rocket that he plans on using for orbital flight. He's going to be launching that out at Cape Canaveral. He's got control of Launch Complex 36. And that's called the New Glenn. The one you see on the website that I just gave you is called the New Shepard, named after Alan Shepard, the first American astronaut. He went suborbital, so this thing goes suborbital. The new one that's coming out that he's released information about a couple of months ago is called the New Glenn. We drop it. Named after our late astronaut John Glenn, who of course went orbital, so this rocket will go orbital, and it's large. It's not quite, but close to the size of the Saturn V rocket. It's getting up there, so, and that'll run on a different kind of fuel. That'll run on liquid methane and liquid oxygen. So he's going to be able to put a lot of people into orbit for a lot of satellites, or if he wants to go up to Mars with Elon Musk, he could do it with this thing. Back to you, sir.
In the past, liquid rocket engines used as fuel liquid oxygen and liquid hydrogen. Liquid oxygen and I think kerosene, but I'm hearing now liquid oxygen plus methane, and maybe that's liquid methane. How come we haven't used methane up till now? Did it require some kind of a breakthrough? Do you get a lot of energy out of that one? I'm guessing liquid methane is easier to handle than liquid hydrogen, a lot easier to handle. But I'll bet you don't get quite as much thrust out of it. Maybe that's the trade-off. WS2N, KQRIW.
Yeah, you don't get as much thrust, but the rocket is bigger, so you compensate for that. I mean, it's big. I've seen comparisons with Saturn V. It's up there. It's physically bigger than Elon Musk's three rockets put together, which is called the Heavy, you know, the Falcon Heavy. And that you'll probably see a test flight this year out of Cape Canaveral. And they're way behind schedule. They were originally going to test that thing. SpaceX was going to test that thing in California in Vandenberg Air Force Base. 2013, 3 years ago. So he's way behind schedule. That's the way a lot of things go in the space race. They make predictions, and some of them come true, but sometimes they're very delayed. So, Elon Musk uses kerosene, you know, purified kerosene for his flights, liquid kerosene. And then there's NASA's Space Launch System, which will eventually go. The earliest flight was, it looks like it's probably going to be the tail end of 2018, a year and a half from now, a little over that. And that uses liquid hydrogen, very similar to the shuttle design. They're going to use a similar tank to what the shuttle used to use, the external tank. So that's got liquid hydrogen. Now, pretty much everybody's using liquid oxygen, so we're going to forget about that. Now, along comes Jeff Bezos, and he wants to use liquid methane. And he'll be doing that for the big rocket. Right now, he's using liquid hydrogen on his smaller rocket on the New Shepard. One that's suborbital, but when he gets over to the new one, he'll be using liquid methane. Now, that'll be used. That same rocket that he's developing is really a new rocket for America. He's got a contract with the United Launch Alliance, which is the company that launches like everything for NASA. Let me drop it. Not everything, but almost everything for NASA. And they launched the Atlas rocket, they launched the Delta II rocket, they launched the Delta IV rocket. Well, the Atlas V that they launch, eventually they would like to change that engine. I have a feeling it's not going to happen, but I think they would like to change that engine to the new engine being built by Blue Origin, and that's called the BE-4 engine. That's with methane. Just don't see that happening. They were talking about that early on. It's definitely going to be used for the United Launch Alliance's next rocket, which comes after the Atlas V rocket, which has got like 100 successful launches, one right after the other. So that their new rocket that they're putting out is called the Vulcan. And they have a contract with the United Launch Alliance, which is really nothing but Boeing and Lockheed. You know, they teamed up together. They call them the ULA, United Launch Alliance. They have a contract with Blue Origin to build the new rocket because they're well along in their development of it. And it's called the BE-4. Let me draw it. BE-4 is that one that they're going to be using methane. So one of the good reasons to use methane compared to kerosene fuel is because you don't need a backup gas. You don't need to pressurize the liquid kerosene that needs to have a backup pressure, and they use helium. And in case of Elon Musk, it looks like the helium tanks are the ones that really let loose. And two occasions, a year and a half apart, they lost the one rocket that they were launching to the space station in flight. That blew up. And then recently, September 1st of this year, or last year, actually now, 2016, they lost the other rocket on the launch pad, which blew up the Amos 6 spacecraft on top of the rocket. And now that has this helium backup system. Now, Jeff Bezos with Blue Origin won't need that with the new rocket that they're developing in New Glenn. Now, coincidentally, or maybe for slightly different reasons, the new rocket that Elon Musk is developing to go to Mars is going to have also methane. But I think the reason he wants to make methane on Mars, he wants to send the rocket, land it on Mars, and he can get methane out of the atmosphere on Mars to refuel his rocket. So that'll have two pluses for him. He won't need the helium backup system, plus he'll be able to make helium methane on Mars. And these are some of the things I've found out over the last couple of years, Dick, regarding this topic. There's other countries using and other people using different fuels, completely different fuels. Japan uses hydrogen, but India uses some other crazy fuel. It just goes on and on. Some of them are from the old days. They like to be able to store for years. Like to be able to store some fuel for years. I mean, you know, you had these rockets that were going to be used for intercontinental ballistic missiles. So they used solid booster rockets and rockets for ICBMs. So now some of them are being retired. So Russia is using a couple of variations of their old ICBMs to put small satellites into space. Orbital ATK is using Pegasus, the one that just put the 8 Cyclone satellites into space to look at the hurricanes. That was the one that was launched from an airplane that has solid fuel on board. So that's all left over from the, you know, from the we had 50,000 rockets pointing at one another. Back to you, Dick.
When it comes to a methane rocket engine, Paul, has anyone ever used that as a fuel with a ground test of the engine? Has anyone ever done a launch of a methane-powered rocket engine? Over to you, Paul. KQRIW.
I haven't heard of one yet, you know. All I know is years ago they said LNG, which is liquid natural gas. You know, I remember hearing stories that this stuff is real dangerous to handle, but I guess that was decades ago, and I guess they have their safety systems built into this stuff. I mean, they wanted to store liquid natural gas, which is really methane, you know. They wanted to store large tanks between Staten Island. I don't know if they were going to put it on the East River or someplace. And then they were going to also put it out here in Long Island Sound between us and Connecticut. People got up in arms about that. And yet they're going to take the same fuel, basically the same, you know, liquid methane, and put it on a rocket, eventually put people on board. Wow. I suspect they have all the safeties built into this stuff. Back to you, Dick. WS4.
For a couple of minutes, Paul, I'd like to discuss science fiction movies that are in the theaters right now. Right now, I think you've got the latest Star Wars movie. You've got a movie, a sci-fi movie called Visitor. And you've got a sci-fi movie called Passenger. On New Year's Eve, my wife and I saw Passenger. Very well done. Good special effects. Nice story. So I've seen Passenger, and I'd recommend it. I wonder if you've seen any of the other two, or any of the three altogether. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, I saw the original Star Wars years ago, back when, in the 70s, and I don't know, I did not become a Star Wars fan. You know, there wasn't enough, wasn't based on enough real physics, and, you know, the Force and all that. I didn't see a connection with even outrageous cosmology. So, but, I've seen other movies. The Martian was great, fantastic movie, and the Interstellar was very good a year or two ago. And Passengers, I want to see. I did want to see that. Hopefully, I get a chance to see it in the movie theater. I have plans on seeing that. I heard that was good. NASA liked it, so if they like it, I like it. And another movie coming out. Let me drop it. I don't know if it's released yet or not. Is Hidden Figures. I'd like to see that as well. Historic reality between the, you know, about the people that were involved with computations of getting a spacecraft from point A to point B back in the 1960s, before they had computers. Had a bunch of women doing this stuff. I'd like to see that. There's another one you mentioned that I haven't heard of yet. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, Visitor. This is where an extraterrestrial intelligence comes to the Earth, and I think a person is assigned to act as a go-between communication-wise. So NASA liked Passengers. Doesn't surprise me. Very good special effects. They must have spent a fortune on those special effects on Passengers. As I said, a nice story. So you're not a Star Wars fan. The Martian was a fun movie to watch, but it did have a couple of fairly serious technical errors. The temperature he was being subjected to on Mars was way hotter than reality. Mars is minus 60 degrees on average. Let me drop it. And he was sitting there with a nice thin spacesuit, lying on the beach each day, letting the solar cells charge his batteries before he does the next bit of traveling. And the wind blowing against that plastic sheeting over his great big airlock, no way in hell. Holding back 14.7 pounds per square inch, no way. So there's a couple of serious technical errors. And poking a hole in his spacesuit and noticing it correct, carefully adjusted thrust to go from point A to point B in space at the end when he had to be rescued. No way. No, you can't do that. You poke a hole in your spacesuit and it's game over. So, and by the way, in the case of Passengers, there was one scene at the end, near the end, in which the star is being subjected to the outgassing of a nuclear power supply. And that was exaggerated, in my opinion. And also,
it's comfortable 70 degrees nearby the poles.
Mars, 70 degrees? Who told you that?
80 degrees Fahrenheit, minus 60 degrees Celsius. Although, it can vary from minus 95 degrees Fahrenheit, minus 25 Celsius, near the poles, up to comfortable think 70 degrees of Fahrenheit at 3 GM.
You're telling me it's cold, it's hotter near the poles than at the equator? Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm reading right now. www.space.com, Mars atmosphere, climate, weather.
Okay, I'll have to look into that. Doesn't sound right. But maybe it's true. So, you're looking forward to passenger and maybe visitor. Passenger is visitor. And there's a third, oh yeah, numbers. Or hidden numbers. The people who did the calculations in the early days, those human beings were called calculators. Now that we've got handheld pieces of machinery that we call calculators, we don't use human beings for that title anymore. Back to you, Paul. WS2N, KQIW.
Yeah, I'm aware of that. They've made that point in talking about it when they, well, in reading about it when I read about it on the NASA site. No, Captain Johnson is involved with that, too. They just gave her an award. She's like 100 years old, and you know, Obama gave her some kind of an award. They named a building after her, so she's still around. I have this chart of all the different planets actually on the desk, so it gives you references. You know, it tells you simple things. You know, it's got two moons and Mars. And the temperatures range between minus 197 Fahrenheit to all the way, it's gone up to 72 degrees Fahrenheit as a max. So, but they don't talk about the poles. I'm sure the poles have got to be colder. I think they must have got those numbers backwards for Wesley, but, maybe, you know. It's got a almost the same tilt as us. It's off by a degree and a half or something. I think they're 25 or something. We're 23 and a half. And as far as the Martian thing, well, that was a movie. They want to do something, I guess, a little different. They put them on the outside of the spacecraft, or the Bulba, when he was resting. But the rest periods in the book was that took place inside the rover deck. Back to you.
Yeah, we've got to reinvestigate them. On a perfect Martian day, in the middle of summer, at high noon on the equator, when the wind isn't blowing, can you get up to 70 degrees? I'll believe that. But that's a rare event. The average temperature is like minus 60 Fahrenheit. And so, you need an awful lot of energy to create enough heat to keep the human being from being frozen. When it comes to operating on the Martian atmosphere and extracting oxygen, water vapor, methane, or whatever, you're starting off with a near vacuum. You're starting off with one-third of the amount of solar energy hitting Mars because of its extra distance from the sun. Let me drop it. So to have enough area of solar cells to get enough solar voltaic kilowatts to run your machinery, to take this near vacuum of the atmosphere, compress it, and then start separating out methane, water vapor, oxygen, and so on. Those words roll off the page real easily. To find the energy to really do that, to have the machinery to really do that, to have that machinery be reliable enough to run 24/7 as it's going to have to do to give you the raw materials for sustaining life. Boy, there's a lot of steps between here and there. You see what I'm worried about here, Paul? WS2N, KQIW.
Oh yeah, they get their hands full. And Elon Musk's idea is, yeah, I can tell the way he's talking. I'll get you there with my big rocket and hope you guys figure out a way to compensate for all these problems, temperature, radiation, and all. You know, some of these websites, well, actually it's a NASA website, but some of them give you far-fetched ideas. You got to watch what you read. But somebody wanted to develop their living facility on Mars made out of ice. that's